Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day, I'm Rob Jan, and welcome aboard the Starship Zero G Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Historical Radio for episode number 1591, entitled "Like a Streak of Light, He Arrives Just in the Nick of Time." Thanks to Frida filling in for Vanessa on Banksia, and our podcast title is Spectacle Podishing. Our co-host Megan McHugh is on shore leave, and we would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of the Wurundjeri, from which we broadcast from and to, and also to elders past, present, and future. When I was doing the podcast for last week's show, I discovered that I'd cut and pasted my notes in a way that omitted mentioning Sigourney Weaver's performance in the Mandalorian and Grogu movie. Weaver played Colonel Ward, a New Republic Adelphi Rangers colonel tasked with assigning the Mandalorian, that is, Din Djarin's targets for his bounty hunting missions. It's more than an extended cameo, since she basically gatekeeps pivotal plot points and also gets to coolly pitch into the action herself later in the film. Look, she's Sigourney Weaver, science fiction filmdom's veteran leading lady, and she can deliver all the role requires, flying inverted and backwards without breaking a sweat. And here's the thing anyway. What killjoy could deny Siggy the considerable fun of bossing Mando around, hanging out with Grogu and taking point leading an X-Wing fighter squadron into battle? This is someone who has paid her genre dues, and then some, and good on her. I have spoken. All right, so, look, I keep an eye on these things, or an ear out in this case. ABC Classics 100, the FM station in 2026. Best of lists. They always put one of these up each year. They're always popularity votes one way or another because it's art and, you know, everybody brings their own baggage to that. And they can be useful for gauging public interest. So I always tune in to that because I want to know what people are thinking about science fiction and fantasy music. Usually they've got all sorts of musical focus over the years. They've included one where they did soundtracks. And this year it was the greatest of all time classical tracks. And time has long passed when soundtracks of movies, TVs and games did not make it into that classical list. And this year was no exception in the top 100 and probably more in the top 200, but I haven't had a chance to check that out yet. Let me see. Coming in at 100 was Indiana Jones, and at 97, the Harry Potter movies. At 87 was Miyazaki's glorious score for Howl's Moving Castle. Interstellar popped up at 86. Pirates of the Caribbean at 82. Jurassic Park at 72. How to Train Your Dragon at 70. I know that's a favourite of Screen Sound's Dan Golding. And also, of course, Doctor Who at 69. And at 51, we had John Barry's Out of Africa. At number 50, Schindler's List popped up, and 20 was Lord of the Rings. Actually, I think there was Breakfast at Tiffany's somewhere, but that's not really a zero-G genre necessarily. Number 20 is, although there are Ginger Ninja Cats in it, or at least one, 20th was Lord of the Rings, and number 13 was The Mission, and coming in at number 12 was Star Wars. So, you know, around about under 15 sort of soundtracks in the list. John Williams, of course, accounted for 5 of those entries. Hans Zimmer was in 2. And I should give a special mention to the ones that weren't soundtracks but were genre-related, like Gustav Holst's The Planets, which always comes in quite low on these lists, and Carmina Burana. And that's one of those ones that I think of as being fantasy genre, but it's just, you know, the classical songs medieval eating and drinking songs being used in the film Excalibur. So there's a few of those like that. Scheherazade is a fantasy. And there wasn't any, I don't think there was any. Also, spake Zarathustra there in the top 100 this year. No doubt would roll over into the next one. And also the top number one was, Beethoven's Symphony number 9 in D minor, which has, of course, the Ode to Joy incorporated within it, which is used in Die Hard, amongst other films and so on. A lot of actually these classical pieces in that top 100 have been used in films and TV shows one way or another. But I will not claim them as a zero-G genre just because of that. Anyway, always fun to listen to that and see what's going on there. And many of those tracks we have indeed played on zero-G over the years. Now, on to a sadder subject. It's been quite a sad couple of years to be a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan, as we lost actress Michelle Trachtenberg in February last year and Nicholas Brendan in March this year. And now Anthony Stewart Head on June the 1st. And Scooby Gangsters knew the British actor, of course, as everyone's favourite librarian and chosen one watcher, Rupert Ripper Giles. Anthony Head, of course, was so much more as an actor, singer and musician. And died of complications of pneumonia, aged 72 recently. Mr. Head was born in London into a showbiz family on February the 20th in 1954. His father was a documentary filmmaker and his mother was an actress. And his older brother, Murray, is a renowned musician and actor in his own right and pioneered the role of Judas Iscariot on the original concept album of Jesus Christ Superstar, as well as being lead vocalist on the Chess concept album hit song One Night in Bangkok. And both brothers would separately play the same role of Freddie Trumper in Chess on stage in London, Murray in 1986 and Tony in 1989. Now, Tony Head's partner, Sarah Fisher, was an animal welfare advocate and a dog trainer, well spoken of in the worldwide community of animal trainers, actually. And their two daughters, Emily and Daisy, are both actresses. Head notes that he knew he wanted to act from about the age of 6 when he appeared in a play organised by family friends, where he was the emperor in The Emperor's New Clothes, and eventually went on to study at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. He broke into both musical theatre and television in the same year in 1978 in Godspell on stage and on screen in the World War II drama Enemy at the Door. In the next decade, he also was a backing vocalist for the band Red Box. So you can see he's a bit of a Renaissance man here. Actor, singer, musician, all sorts of things. And in the popular television commercials for coffee also advanced his brand, and he then literally hit his straps and garters with the iconic role of Frank N. Furter in the 1990 London revival of the genre satire musical The Rocky Horror Show. And he was playing opposite future talk show host Craig Ferguson. Ferguson was playing Brad in that. So, yeah, we do actually have him singing that. Came out as a 7-inch single. Anthony Head singing Sweet Transvestite. I think they actually spun this out into a whole bunch of other records as well, cast recordings and so on. But, yeah, it's kind of does my head in, quite literally, to think of Tony prancing around as Frank N. Furter.
2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ, New York. Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone?
Hi, this is Richard E. Grant, and you're listening to Triple R. Cheers and chin chin.
Yeah, and there you had the late and much lamented Anthony Stewart Head there in his iconic revival role of Frank N. Furter, the 1990 London revival of the Rocky Horror Show, Richard O'Brien's Rocky Horror Show, giving Tim Curry a run for his money there. Now, Anthony Stewart Head went on from what could have been a breakout role as a musician on genre detective show Jonathan Creek, but that was cut short. Was he a musician in that? No, I think he was a magician. I have conflated words there. Quite an arrogant and aggressive magician, actually. And that was cut short in the late 1990s when Head headed off for the United States to play the watcher and mentor of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the now classic television series. Such fond memories of Giles' performance in that show. The actor as well. Weird moments when he played an earlier punk rocker type, Mr. Giles, known as the Ripper. I remember the quiet moments too, when the character did so well. One particularly dark one when the character of Giles, who's basically the mild-mannered librarian, literally snuffed out the Ben/Glory big bad monster of the season by pinching the temporarily paralysed creature's nostrils shut and suffocating them, explaining all the while that Buffy would never do that because she was a hero, but that he, Giles, and the monster were not. Amazing moment in that show. And the season finale, that was the gift, I think, that one, for season 5. And then there's all those bits where he's Buffy's watcher and mentor and sort of a stand-in father figure for the whole cast and distancing himself from the Watcher's Council. He got fired to champion Buffy's cause. Then when he lost his love interest, Miss Jenny Callender, the computer whiz, and turned all Avenger upon Angelus the vampire, which was an unwise thing to do, but nevertheless he was up for it. And he felt so sorry for Giles, saddled with the endlessly perky valley kids in an endlessly sunny non-British world, wrapped up in his tweed and occasionally his, what was he driving? It was a French car, I think, actually. And it was one of those comic cars that you get around in these shows. And the episode we got turned into a demon and had to basically be the monster of the week for that week. Or the one, what was the episode called? Band Candy, where he got to, he had to become that teenage Ripper character once more and was flirting with Buffy's mum, Joyce. And, of course, the glorious Once More With Feeling as well, which I should play today sometime. If I can locate the CD. But first, I think I'll play another track here from Mr. Giles, that is to say Anthony Stewart Head. At one stage, he did Repo, the Genetic Opera, and did a character in that. And I've got that track here today too. It's called Legal Assassin. And this is Anthony Stewart Head. We'll play this right now here on Zero G as we're doing a bit of a tribute to the actor who has died at the age of 72.
This is Matthew Riley, creator of the Scarecrow and Jack West Jr. series, and you're listening to 3RRR FM.
Yeah, and you just heard Anthony Stewart Head singing Legal Assassin from Repo, the Genetic Opera, where he played an organ repossessor, which is set in a 21st century. And he was working for a medical firm that could do that sort of thing. A bit of a naughty track, that one. But then he had a remarkable side for doing that kind of thing. What a range Stewart Head had. He had been quite able to play the villain, quite able to play the mentor, quite able to play the hero, and every role in between. Of course, known for his turn on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where he was there for most of the seasons, but then become a semi-regular in the last couple towards the end of the run of the show. A lot of roles on television, the actor, major roles in a show called Man-Child. Of course, he was the Prime Minister of the UK in Little Britain, and King Uther Pendragon in the Merlin series. A thankless role in many ways. He was sort of like the stick-in-the-mud king who was frowning upon Arthur's friendship with the rather strange Merlin the Magician, young Merlin in this case. But, you know, there were moments where the character did stand out as being a worthy scion for King Arthur. Not too many, because if you know the backstory of that, it's kind of complicated. I don't think they actually went there in the series. Though they might have, I don't know. It was supposed to be a kid's show. And, of course, he played the thoroughly disreputable Richmond Football Club owner, not Australia, that is, Rupert Mannion in Ted Lasso for some memorable seasons of that. I suppose Doctor Who fans will remember most for playing Headmaster Finch, an alien in disguise bent on invading Earth in the era of David Tennant's Doctor. And in fact, Anthony Stewart had also auditioned for the role of the Eighth Doctor for the telly movie back in the mid-90s, lost out to Paul McGann, the actor who played the Doctor, the Eighth Doctor, fairly briefly in that telly movie, and later on sort of reprised that role again briefly, but also did a lot of that Eighth Doctor on audio books in the Big Finish series. And of course, Anthony was also known for being a voice actor. Video games like Destroy All Humans 2 and Flip's Twisted Roll, as well as being in the exclusive audio series Slayers, a Buffyverse story, where, again, he was Mr. Giles alongside people like Juliet Landau, Amber Benson, Emma Caulfield Ford, Charisma Carpenter, and James Masters. And that one came out in 2023. And he also did radio as well, where he played a dual role of Mr. Gently Benevolent and his descendant, Jeremy Sorquill, in the BBC Radio 4 comedy series Bleak Expectations back in 2007 to 2012. He was also in a show called Cabin Pressure and in the iconic British soap The Archers. We also have seen him on television in Silent Witness, Spooks, and Monarch of the Glen as well. Appeared in his final roles as Lord Sheffield in the second season of Bridgerton in 2022 and in the video film, the Amazon Prime video film, Upgraded in 2024. In between all of this and that, he ended up releasing albums with various people. Of course, the Once More We're Feeling album from the 2001 episode, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that's the track we've got in here from that album called Standing, depicting a part of the show where Giles sadly realised that he might actually be standing in the way of Buffy's future as a slayer. She needs to let go and for her to come into her own. Now, other albums included Face in the Window, a 1983 album he did with Two Way, the band. That Sweet Transvestite one that you heard before, the single. Music for Elevators in a collaboration with George Serra in 2002. A single called Cry, which was written by Marina Florence for the Oldie Composers Competition, and Staring at the Sun, 2014 album, where he's got both cover doing some covers and original songs, one of which I think we've got for later on called Another Hero Died Tonight, which he penned in reaction to the passing of several of his own personal heroes. But we'll play that later on at the end of the show. For now, we shall say valet to actor Anthony Stewart Head, playing a track from Once More We're Feeling, Buffy the Vampire Slayer musical, the original cast album.
This is Sir Derek Jacobi 0G or not 0G? That is the question.
Yeah, it was Anthony Stewart Head singing Standing from the cast album of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Once More With Feeling. The actor, of course, has died at the age of 72 from complications of pneumonia. I remember there's an episode of Buffy where Buffy is feeling pretty bleak and she asked Giles to lie to her to cheer her up, and he said, "The good guys are always stalwart and true. The bad guys are easily distinguished by their pointy horns or black hats, and we always defeat them and save the day. No one ever dies and everybody lives happily ever after." So vale, Anthony Stewart Head. We'll play another track later at the end of the show from his album, Staring at the Sun. All right, so Spider Noir. Noir, see? Now, we've had an excellent run of Marvel on television this year. Wonder Man, Daredevil's Born Again Season 2, and the Punisher special. And they've dropped streaming onto Amazon Prime the 8 episodes of Spider Noir. Now, before we begin, if anyone wants to get out, please don't slam the door. As you exit, you'll break the window, and it's murder getting my name painted on that frosted glass. So, right, back to the 1930s, where publisher Harry Steger, when inspired by a passing spider he saw at a tennis court, and other fictional vigilantes like the Shadow, Steger created a masked pulp detective fiction character known as the Spider in a decade's worth of monthly installments from 1933 to 1943. The successful character was spun off into novels and radio and two notable Columbia movie serials in 1938 and 1941, and has been revived since across several mediums, including comic books. But of course, it's in the influence of the character that the Spider has swung into our hearts. It is said that the Spider was one of several influences in the creation of Marvel Comics' iconic Spider-Man, attributed to collaborative interactions between Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, and Joe Simon, amongst others. And Spider-Man, of course, went on to dominate the pop culture web since before it went digitally worldwide. With Marvel's well-known passion for creating multiversal variants of its characters, sooner or later it was obvious that their default back to the 1930s/40s era that also saw the creation of some of their own key characters like Captain America. And so, Spider-Noir, created by David Hein and Fabrice Sapolsky as part of the Marvel Noir Comics universe in 2009. It's set in the Great Depression in America and reimagines what would happen if Spider-Man was had his first origin story then instead of in the 1960s. Carmen Di Giacomecchio was the artist who created the look, as well as Marco Djurjevic, who did the costume design. It was a four-part comic book miniseries from 2009. Spawned a sequel not long after that, and also appeared in many other comics. Had the character, well, you're not really a Marvel Comics character until you've been killed in a comic and then rebooted later on. Eventually got his own title in some monthly comics for a while too. Other media, we've seen Spider-Noir, or just Noir as he's sometimes known. In 2010, a video game called Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions. He was voiced by actor Christopher Barnes. In the Ultimate Spider-Man animated series, great little series that one, voiced by Milo Ventimiglia. In 2018, of course, in the magnificent Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse movie, the animated one, he was voiced by Nicolas Cage. Also popped up in a non-speaking but live-action glimpse in another animated movie, the sequel to that, Across the Spider-Verse, where he's caged, he's actually caged in that one. This is setting the stage for the Cage and the director, producer, American film screenwriter, Oren Uziel, who is known for Mortal Kombat Rebirth in 2010, The Cloverfield Paradox in 2018, and The Lost City in 2022. as well as working on the television show. What is it? Hannibal. Yes, that's right. In 2010, and also the Punisher in 2017. That would be the Netflix one. Actually, he's worked alongside Steve Lightfoot, who's also the co-showrunner for this. He's the one who worked on Hannibal and The Punisher. Oren Uziel. That's right. He worked on Freaks of Nature as well as some other shows. Anyway, these are the two creators behind this and a raft of executive producers, including Nicolas Cage himself and other producers who worked on Into the Spider-Verse. So they're coming from a good position, I feel, to get into this. Nicolas Cage is playing Ben Reilly. That's his alias in this. And he's actually Peter Parker, but, you know, we're not counting here. And he plays Ben Reilly, the detective, the private eye in 1930s New York City. And also the spider vigilante. But he's not playing the spider in this to start with. He's given up playing the spider for reasons, which we'll get into, and has now just been a private eye for 5 years. Not a very successful one either. Nicolas Cage. You know, they often say you can fairly judge a person by where they first saw Tim Curry. But in this case, I'm thinking, what did I see Nicolas Cage in first? Look, if you were a normal person, you probably saw him in Fast Times at Ridgemont High back in, 82. Or perhaps Rumblefish or The Cotton Club or Birdie, maybe even Peggy Sue Got Married or Raising Arizona. But I think I first encountered him in either 87 or 88 in Moonstruck or Vampire's Kiss. One of the two. Both of them left a memorable impression, and both in some ways are representative of Nicolas Cage's acting career after that. Either some quite interesting mainstream movie, which is to say Moonstruck, or something very strange like Vampire's Kiss. I went on to enjoy his work over time, obviously in The Rock and Con Air and Face Off, Snake Eyes. I have not seen Captain Corelli's Mandolin from 2001, but I'm open to watching that someday. Wind Talkers and the National Treasures movies where he plays the adventurer. I have heard his voice in The Ant Bully and, of course, in that ill-judged The Wicker Man. And, of course, he has been in the Marvel Universe as Johnny Blaze in the 2007 Ghost Rider. I think was that actually filmed here in Australia? I believe so. Of course, he had brief sort of appearances in the Grindhouse pastiche with, I think the segment he was in was Fu Manchu in Werewolf Women of the SS or something dreadful like that. I don't think I saw him again or actually heard his voice until the animated Astro Boy movie, but really he came into focus for me where he was playing the Big Daddy vigilante superhero in Kick-Ass, very much like Batman in that one, of course, but sort of skewed. And Season of the Witch, I saw him in that too. Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance in 2011. What after that? A few stops between stations there. Oh, yes, U.S. Indianapolis Men of Courage, about the ship that was carrying the atomic bomb to be dropped on Hiroshima. Then there was, after that, so many movies. Not all I've seen. Probably I've not seen some of the worst ones, but I have seen some of the better ones, like Mandy. I thought that was a better one. And The Colour Out of Space, that enormously wonderful excursion into H.P. Lovecraft-dom. And most recently, of course, we've got Pig, which is an excellent movie, and Renfield, where he gets to play Dracula, another over-the-top, probably misjudged part, but he gave it his all, as he does all the time. And also Arcadian, a science fiction post-apocalypse movie, and Longlegs, where he plays a very strange serial killer. So I've actually seen quite a few Nicolas Cage movies all up. And here he is playing Spider-Man at last, an older Spider-Man, world-weary and haunted by the death of his girl, Ruby, who he was not able to save, which is kind of a seminal sin of the Spider-Man character, always haunted by the death of someone, feeling responsible for that. But he's been not a spider vigilante for at least 5 years. He's been a down at heels, just scraping by private detective. And it's all going to come back and hit him in the face. You know that. Poor old damaged goods Ben Reilly, the noir gumshoe in Spider Noir. His powers are stuttering. His back is hurting. He doesn't really expect any new romantic interest to enter his life at this stage, but there you go. It's a noir parody or a pastiche or an homage, all of those things at once. I really like the way that Nicolas Cage and the directors and the writers come up with an in-universe explanation of why he talks like a noir gumshoe with all of the classic sort of expressions. Cage says that he was playing Ben Reilly, obviously he's looking to people like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart, Edward G. Robinson and so on. But he is really also playing this as Spider-Man. Basically, he says that he's doing it as a spider who is cosplaying as a human being, which is an extraordinary take on it. And, you know, it's got precedent in the comic books, but I've not seen an actor lean into it like this before. So he's actually, to me, he's one of the most unique and unusual Spider-Man ever to thwip a web. He's plays this with spider twitches as too, which could have come across as totally ridiculous, but in this case it works like gangbusters, that other sort of noir sort of era show. And it's best seen, I think, the character when he's working both sides of the street at once, which is a classic noir trope. So I cannot say too much good about his performance as Ben Reilly. It is just exquisite, and it's wonderful to see him play both characters, the spider and also Ben Reilly, leaning into all of those things, leaning into them so far back that he falls over and off the side of a building. It's just a tour de force performance, and one of the best Spider-Man performances that I've ever seen. Great interpretation. It would not be anywhere near as good, though, without a great cast. It's an excellent ensemble. Lamorne Morris, American actor and comedian, who we know from New Girl. And I saw him in the fifth season of Fargo, where he played the state trooper Whitley. He's also been in Barbershop, The Next Cut, and played a comedian in Saturday Night. He was in the Jumanji series too, playing a part in those. And here he is playing Robbie Robertson, a newspaper reporter, in the Spider-Noir series. And again, he's kind of like a story arc that mirrors Ben Reilly's. He's on a bit of a downer career-wise, but he's aspiring to go up again. And he's kind of like a Jiminy Cricket for Ben Reilly's character, but always providing something, I think, of an inspiration for Ben Reilly and helping him move along. Playing Joe Robbie Robinson in this one. It does work for the Daily Bugle at one stage. They do mention in passing that Ben Reilly is a bit of a photographer too, so missed out there in this case because Robbie gets the journalistic gig there. He's an eternal optimist. And by the way, because as you probably know, Spider-Noir is shot in both black and white and something they call true colour, which is very much like a sort of a tinted Technicolor. I did think it was early for Technicolor for noir, but I was wrong, actually. It goes back much earlier. So when you're watching it in black and white, you can have the option of flicking over to the colour version. And it's really worth doing, at least at the start of every Robbie Robertson scene where he's wearing a new costume, because he ends up in these outrageously cheeky coloured suits that both hit you in the face but are also really cool. So, yeah, that's one reason for watching both with the option to flick over to it. Great character in this. Lu Jun Lee plays Felicia Cat Hardy, who you will know from Spider-Man's stable of friends and enemies in this case, and also actually in the comic books too. She's not quite the Black Cat character in the comic books. She's a different interpretation of that, but she nevertheless does play the femme fatale role in this story. Now, we've seen Lee Jun Lee before, especially in the series The Exorcist, and she played Grace Chow, the grocery store owner in Sinners, one of the great vampire movies of last year, in fact, the great vampire movie of 2025. And she was also the character in The Last of Us, who was the mother of Yara and Lev in the third season. Now, she draws, the actress, that is Lee Jun Lee, playing Felicia Hardy Cat, as they give her the nickname in this one. She has played Babylon, the Babylon character in the television show, who was based on Anna May Wong. So that's an interesting thing, because she takes iconic Anna May Wong, who was an Asian-American actress back in the day, who got a lot of amazing sort of femme fatale roles but kind of got typecast along the way. But she was informed by that character for Babylon, and she's also using the same sort of mix for the character in this one, although she's also referencing Kim Basinger and Lauren Bacall and Rita Hayworth and so on. Her character, Kat, is one of the hardest, literally hardest working characters in Spider-Noir. She's a nightclub singer, but she's also kept in a gilded cage by the chief gangster in the story, Silvermane. Plus, there's also some complications coming up with Nicolas Cage. I think she's a great character in this, and she gets to sing and do all that sort of stuff and wear some amazing costumes. Again, one of those ones where you flick across to the colour one to check out the costumes in full colour, because you know that they're going to be great in that as well. The funny thing is that it reads like they've done a colourised version of the original Spider-Noir in black and white, but of course they kind of filmed it at the same kind and they were using filters and stuff. But it looks like a photo that's a black and white photo that's been tinted, you know, hand tinted, which is what they used to do before Photoshop. So let's have a track here. Do we have her singing? Yes, we do. So let's pop that up here. Actually, I'll give you first the spider, which is the opening title credits for this, and that's by Chris Bowers and Michael Dean Parsons, composers. And we'll give you that, and then we'll segue over into Dream a Little Dream of Me, which is, of course, a classic song. But this is sung by Lee Jun Lee from Spider-Noir, the series.
Hello, this is Paul McGann. I play the eighth incarnation of the Doctor, and you are listening to 3RRR FM.
You heard there Lee Jun Lee, who plays Cat Hardy in the Spider-Noir series, and that was Dream a Little Dream of Me, a 1930s song, originally music by Fabian Andre and Wilbur Schwand, and lyrics by Gus Kahn, been recorded 400 times since by everybody from Ella Fitzgerald to Henry Mancini and the Mills Brothers too. Just an amazing song when interpreted that way. Of course, Torch Song 4, a femme fatale in the series in best noir tradition. Other people in the show Spider-Noir, I did want to touch base with Karen Rodriguez playing Ben Reilly's secretary, Janet Reese. We've seen her before in The Hunting Wives and Shining Girls, but here she is awesomely good. She may actually be a smarter private investigator than Ben Reilly. She's certainly more sober. And, of course, she's carrying a bit of torch for the Ben Reilly character herself. And the actress has a great range of complicated expressions that speak volumes when she does various things in scenes in this. Obviously, Ben Reilly would not be able to function as either a human being or as a vigilante or as a private detective without the help of Janet, a standout character in Spider-Noir. Also, shouting out to the actors who play the various other super villains as such, although this is a noir show. It's got black, it's got white, it's got grey characters in terms of their moral compasses. Jack Huston plays Flint Marko, the Sandman. We've seen him in Boardwalk Empire, where, oddly enough, he played a World War I sniper who became a gangster, not entirely separate from the character that he's playing here. He is entangled with the femme fatale Cat, and he's got some problems with his Sandman superpowers. He's actually quite a tragic figure, and one of the standout characters in this show who could have just been a throwaway sort of supervillain, but no, they've actually gone deep into the character in a way that reminds me of some of the better Spider-Man movies where they've attempted the same thing as well. Not exactly foreign to the comic book treatment of the character either. What else did I see Jack Huston? The 2016 Ben-Hur, where he played the title character. Main character in the fourth season of Fargo. And he was George Wickham in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, too. Speaking of the villains, we've got the character of Lonnie Lincoln / Tombstone, played by Abraham Papoula, and he was in the Morbius movie. Won't hold that against him. But I remember him most from the Amazon Prime video show The Rig, where he was one of the ill-fated oil rig workers. And he was also in the Atlas film with Jennifer Lopez. But he was in the Marvel Universe in the Marvels movie in 2023 and popped up in Andor as well as one of the characters in that. Continuing the line of the supervillains in this, Andrew Lewis Caldwell does a memorable turn as the Shakespeare-quoting theatre kid who drives public transport in this. He's playing Electro / Megawatt in this one, and he literally lights up the screen every time he's on. A very interesting character. Reminds me a little bit of General Chang from Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, in his passion for quoting Shakespeare at very appropriate times. Now, leaning into the villainous side of the cast, Brendan Gleeson is here playing Finbar Byrne, that is to say Silvermane, kind of like the kingpin of crime in New York in the fictional 1930s that this is set in. 1933, I think, was the date I saw in the newspaper. He's an Irish mob boss, and look, we don't need to go into Brendan Gleeson's backstory. He's been around for a long time. He's played a lot of villains, especially in this sort of genre, Michael Collins, Gangs of New York, and so on. And here he is. It's this self-aware villain whose tough upbringing has made him what he is today, or yesterday, a violent, controlling bully who wears a veneer of sophistication, not all that far off of Kingpin, actually, when you think about it. So, yeah, an amazing performance with him. And his best scenes are opposite to Lelou Lynn, where he's playing her sort of sugar daddy, but in a weird kind of way, even beyond the normal transcendent role that would suggest to you. Great character, and has some great scenes with Nicolas Cage in this too. Plays very well opposite him. Look, there are dozens of other people in this, but touch base on Andrew Robinson playing the secretary to the mad doctor of the show. Andrew Robinson, of course, Garak from Deep Space Nine, Star Trek, and from Hellraiser. I first saw him in Dirty Harry, actually, playing Scorpio, the serial killer in that one. Nice to see him still getting some roles like this one. And he is, again, another sympathetic character in this. Emma Aquino is playing the mad doctor. Is she mad, though, or is she just annoyed because of things that have happened to her son? we'll have to see. She played a character in The Falcon and The Winter Soldier, actually, Dr. Christina Raynor. She is suitably focused upon experimenting upon people who have superpowers in this. So that actually manages to twist the show into this horror, whole sort of horror mode. It is a great show. It's got great costumes. It's got great music. It is fantastically realized as noir. We have everything in this, the mean rainy streets, so much rain in this. And, you know, the flickering neon, three-pieced heavy suits, pursuit through halls of mirrors, venting steam, nightclub torch singers, femme fatales, world-wearing gumshoes, sidekicks and sassy secretaries, mad doctors, corrupt officials, crime kingpins and complex villains who are grey, all seen in Dutch tilt, and you can watch it in colour as well, which is somehow seems extra seedy. But that's about it for us today. We'll go for a track by Chris Bowers and Michael Dean Parsons, a little bit of In the Beginning from the Spider Noir series. And Joe Bernadic is coming up next with Astral Glamour.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.